Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a leading consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I facilitate strategic business opportunities in digital distribution between innovative tech companies, talent and media companies, and consumer brands in order to create new revenue streams between them and to deliver compelling consumer experiences. As a trusted advisor, I'm a conduit for transforming the quality of people's lives. And I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Carla Harris. Carla is a vice chairman, global wealth management, managing director, and senior client advisor at Morgan Stanley. She was recently named chair of the Executive Leadership Council. She's got extensive industry experience across the tech, media, retail, telecommunications, transportation, industrial, and healthcare sectors. For more than a decade, Carla was a senior member of the Equity Syndicate Desk and executed IPOs for UPS, Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia, Ariba, Digitas, and many others. She holds degrees from Harvard University and Harvard Business School, as well as numerous honorary doctorates. Carla is the author of two influential books, including Expect to Win, 10 Proven Strategies for Thriving in the Workplace, and we'll also talk about her new book. And she's been featured in Fortune's 50 Most Powerful Black Executives in America and the Most Influential list, as well as Black Enterprise Magazine's 50 Most Powerful Women in Business and Essence Magazine's 50 Women Who Are Shaping the World, among others. In August 2013, President Obama appointed Ms. Harris as the chairperson of the National Women's Business Council. What a resume. Welcome to the show, Carla.
Well, thank you very much, Kelly, and thanks for having me.
It's my privilege. I've been looking forward to this for some time. Now, Carla, going back to when you were young, you were first and foremost a musician, singing choral music and in gospel choirs, becoming quite accomplished at that, and then starting your own band in college and eventually putting on two sold-out shows in Carnegie Hall, as I understand it. How has music influenced your approach to business and life?
Well, thanks a lot, Kelly. And yes, I've been singing for quite a long time, and I actually did four sold-out concerts at Carnegie Hall.
Stand corrected.
Yeah, and I'll say that music certainly influenced who I am as a business person, because as a musician and certainly as a singer, you have to be very good at listening. And what I have found is being a good listener has also helped me a lot in business, especially in a business where your ability to penetrate relationships is important. Because when people know that you are listening to them, it creates a value chain, if you will, in that relationship, because everybody wants to be heard. Everybody wants to be listened to.
Yes.
And I think that I have the ability to hear those things that people mean yet are not articulating.
And so in the nuances of your singing, you've had to pay that kind of attention, and that's translated to the nuances of listening and conversation with people.
Absolutely. And in addition, also as a musician, you have to be pretty quick on your feet in terms of thinking, because you may have someone that plays a note differently, or if you have a really, really good musician that's accompanying you, you know, he may really get excited and start doing a few other riffs. And again, you can't show that there's a problem in the song. You just got to go right through it, or you got to go with it if he's doing something right and great. It's just different. So I think the ability to think quickly on my feet has also helped me as a business person.
I would say so. And I think that one other thing I would weave into this part of the conversation is the importance that you learn from being part of a group of collaboration with others.
Absolutely. Very good point, Kelly.
And I know that served you well across all the many things you've done. It's all been about collaboration.
Absolutely, because there are very few things that you do in any business that you truly do alone. And especially in a service business, there's always a team that is delivering you know, the ultimate product or process to the client. And you have to be willing to, you know, to be a good team member as well as a leader and know when you have to put on, you know, which hat, if you will. And one of the things that I'm fond of saying is that you cannot lead if other people won't follow. And I think that if the better you are at being a good team member, it can inform and influence positively who you are as a leader.
Oh, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Now, tell us a bit about your Ivy League experience, Carla. Do you think that an Ivy League degree is worth the same thing today as it was when you earned yours?
Absolutely, Kelly, and I'll tell you that my decision to go to Harvard undergrad and my decision to go to Harvard Business School are two of a few of the decisions that I would repeat again in a heartbeat. I really had an amazing experience in undergrad in particular. I grew up in the South, in Jacksonville, Florida, and in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, growing up in the South, you kind of know black and white, or that's what you focus on from a demographic. But you don't really focus on, you know, Trinidadian, Jamaican, Sinhalese, or Russian, or somebody who's Parisian or somebody who is from Morocco, for example. And when I went to Harvard, I was able to, you know, really explore and experience the breadth of different types of people and learn as much from them, frankly, as I did from the professors that I had the privilege to study with. So it was an amazing experience.
Yeah, notwithstanding the fact, of course, that in these years it's become ridiculous in terms of people graduating, if they're even able to get in, with huge debt. And that's another piece of this, but I don't know if we want to go down that road. But that's become quite different for both, you know, both of us being of a certain age when we went to school.
Yeah,
I really feel for the kids trying to deal with all that today.
Yeah, but you know what, Kelly, I'll say this to that, that back then the amount of debt that I took on seemed like it was really huge. So I haven't done the analysis to see, you know, whether it's an exponential difference or if it's a relativity argument, if you know what I mean. What I paid was, you know, multiples more than what my mother paid, for example, when she went to college. So, again, I don't know how much of it is a relative argument versus there being, you know, an absolute huge change. But I do think that investing in yourself is one of the best investments that you can ever make. So I certainly came out of college with a lot of undergraduate debt. But given the fact that I went to a great school, worked really hard, had a good track record, it enabled me to get a good job and enabled me to whittle down those loans, you know, relatively quickly. But make no mistake, I walked out of there with a pretty hefty leverage amount over my head.
Sure, sure. But it sounds to me like it was definitely worth it.
Yes.
Now, Carla, is the work you're doing today what you thought you'd be doing when you left school? Was there ever a time in your career when you had to pivot and change course?
No, I'll tell you that the work I'm doing today in investment banking is definitely what I sought out to do when I left Harvard Business School. Now, it wasn't necessarily what I thought I was going to do when I entered Harvard undergrad. When I entered Harvard undergrad, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. But part of that was, Kelly, that I had never been exposed to anybody in finance. I had never been exposed to anybody in banking. So I really did not know about this at all until the summer after my sophomore year at Harvard. I had the good fortune of getting an internship through the SEO program, which introduced me to finance and introduced me to Wall Street. Had I not had that, I very probably could have been a lawyer, no question about it, because that's what I thought I was going to do when I walked into Harvard undergrad.
Sure. Now, have you ever regretted the course your career's taken?
Not at all. I have really enjoyed the journey that I've had in finance. It has been diverse. It has been challenging, both intellectually and physically. It has given me basically another set of skills that I did not acquire in undergrad or in business school. So it's been an amazing journey.
I'll say. I don't know too many people who have that kind of pedigree as you. It's astounding. And, of course, you've come by it honestly. Can you tell us a story, Carla, about a challenge you might have faced as a woman on Wall Street and how you overcame it?
Well, I'll tell you, Kelly, the biggest challenge that I faced, frankly, was not understanding that there are other things in your success equation other than just being smart and working hard. When I started in this business, I certainly embraced the concept of a meritocracy, which almost any company talks about, and certainly every company in financial services talks about. But I quickly figured out that being smart and working hard wasn't enough. You needed to understand some of the intangibles, which, as you know, I wrote about in my book called Expect to Win. It was things like understanding the power of relationships and that you needed a sponsor to speak for you behind closed doors, because all of the decisions about your career are frankly made when you are not in the room. So who's carrying your paper into the room and what are they going to say? It was also understanding that perception is the co-pilot to reality. How people perceive you will directly impact how they deal with you, and more importantly, that you have the power to train people to think about you in the way that you want them to think about you. These were things, Kelly, that I wish I had known when I started in this business, and frankly, they were hard lessons to learn, but very valuable lessons that I continue to use today.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I know that those are missing modules that they didn't hand out at Harvard or anywhere else for that matter.
Right.
Now, how do you see things evolving for women in Wall Street and investment banking? And how does your appointment to the National Women's Business Council play a role in that?
Sure. I think things have certainly evolved over the time that I've been on Wall Street. Make no mistake, we still have a long way to go, but there are more women broadly than there were when I started in the business in 1987, and certainly more women that have gotten to the officer level than when I started in 1987. My role as chair of the National Women's Business Council is to focus these 15 women total that are on the council on being a consultative body to the president or to the White House, to the SBA, and to Congress around issues as they relate to women entrepreneurs. And the council is focused on four key pillars: access to capital, because that continues to be a major impediment for the origination of women-owned businesses.
Sure.
With respect to scale. We focus on access to jobs, and that really is all about the scaling argument, access to markets, focusing on federal procurement, and also in the private sector with supplier diversity programs, and then finally focusing on the data so that we can tell the story about the multiplier effect of women entrepreneurship and job creation in the country.
Yeah, it's an incredibly important role, and I'm just so pleased that you were given the opportunity to be in that capacity, because I think you're going to make a huge difference, you and the other women on the council.
Thank you very much. It's a very powerful council, and I really do. I agree with you, Kelly. I think we have an opportunity to put our imprimatur on it in a way that hasn't been done before.
Yeah, I mean, I speaking from personal experience, of course, I come out of two male-dominated professions, technology and entertainment, and have really had to find my way as an individual because, again, there's no rule book about how to succeed in that kind of a structure.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate everything you're doing.
Thank you.
Your first book, Carla, was called Expect to Win, 10 Proven Strategies for Thriving in the Workplace. I loved it. And in it, one of the things you stress is that you can't do it alone, as we talked about earlier. You talk about the mentor, the advisor, and the sponsor. Who are these archetypes, and why are these rules and why are these roles so important to one's success and well-being?
Yes. And the first thing, Kelly, is that, you know, so often I find that we broadly, but certainly women, will adopt the strategy of putting our heads down and working really hard and thinking that we'll be recognized and rewarded for that. And it doesn't always work out that way. You're going to need somebody else's relationships in order to maximize your success. And I wrote about the advisor, the mentor, and the sponsor because popular business press at the time loved to say you need a mentor, you need a mentor, you need a mentor, but they didn't tell you what a mentor is supposed to do for you, nor do they delineate the difference between the mentor and the sponsor. And I've been talking about sponsorship since 1990, and at that time nobody was using the word sponsor. And I continued to talk about it, and now people are doing research around sponsorship. They're writing books around sponsorship, the same people who were in the audience when I was talking about it and defining it back in the 90s. And I could not be more thrilled because, indeed, it is the critical relationship. The advisor is the person that you can ask discreet questions of. Oh, Kelly, I'm going to be working with Dan. Can you introduce me to him? I'd like to get to know him before we start this project. That's an example of a discrete question, and you can ask of any advisor. And the profile of an advisor is anybody in your environment that has the intellect and or the experience to answer whatever question you have.
Sure.
The mentor, on the other hand, is the person that you tell the good, the bad, and the ugly to. So this is the person that you can share the intimate details of your career with, your fears, your concerns, your mistakes, your strategies. So this person must know you very well, and you must trust them. This person does not need to be within your organization, nor do they need to look like you, but they must understand the context that you're working in, because a mentor's job is to give you tailored advice, tailored specifically to you and to your career aspirations.
Exactly.
Now, different than the mentor is the sponsor. The sponsor must be in your organization. They must have a seat at the decision-making table, and they must have the juice to get it done for you. This is the person that is carrying your paper into the room. This is the person that behind closed doors will argue passionately on your behalf as to why you should get the bonus, why you should get the promotion, why you should get the next great opportunity. Make no mistake, this person is spending their valuable political and social capital on you. So that's the difference between the advisor, the mentor, and the sponsor.
Now, in my work as a trusted advisor, Carla, I actually blend two of those, the mentor and the advisor. In this so-called trusted advisor role that I've coined the phrase of, in the context of how I do it, it's a combination of coaching, having been certified as a coach, you know, my years of experience in the business as an executive, strategic insights, and access to my network as a so-called super connector.
Okay.
They get all of that when I work with someone. But the key is trust.
Yes.
And it's personal and professional.
That's exactly right.
So it's a little bit of a hybrid from the way you've described things so beautifully as discreet. But, you know, that's how we work these days. It's not always black and white.
Right. And I'll bet, Kelly, that when you start in a relationship with someone, you're more the advisor than you are the mentor because you don't know them very well. So how can there be a relationship of trust? But as you invest in that relationship, then the trust is something that hopefully develops or is earned or however you want to look at it. And that's what allows you to really give that tailored advice as a mentor and gives you the confidence to open up your network, yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because it works both ways. You have to earn the trust of the client, and they have to earn your trust to open up your network.
Absolutely.
Now, and I, like you, I think, have been privileged to have corporate sponsors in the corporate environment, and that has made all the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have gotten my MBA through Apple if an Apple executive had not been my sponsor, because you had to have one to get into that program.
Wow.
How does one who aspires to work with people like this get access and encourage these very important individuals to work on your behalf or work alongside you?
Yes, and you start to look in your organization and study it very closely. So when you're trying to find a sponsor, you look in your organization and you ask the following questions. Who has access to my work, or who is in a position where I could get projects or get some kind of exposure to that person? Who has a seat at the decision-making table? Who has authority and power in the organization or influence in the organization? And once you've answered those questions, then you can target the people that fit that profile, and you start to build a relationship with them in the very same way that you build any relationship in your personal life. It's no different. And most of us build relationships by frequency of touch. You spend time with people, or you're getting coffee with them, or you're getting to know them, or you're working with them on something. And hopefully what naturally happens is that a sponsor-type relationship develops, and you know that they're going to be the person that will pound the table for you behind closed doors. If it's not clear, then you must exercise your power and ask someone to sponsor you. And the conversation goes like this: Kelly, you know, it's important to me to get promoted this year. I know you've had a lot of exposure to my work. You and I both know I'm going to need someone behind closed doors that's going to argue on my behalf or will pound the table on my behalf. Do you feel comfortable playing that role for me? My job is to give you the strongest package possible as you walk into the room, and your job obviously would be to try to get it done for me. I know there are no guarantees, but I want to have the comfort that someone's going to be able to speak up on my behalf at the appropriate time behind closed doors. Can you do that for me? Period.
Boy, I tell you, everything you've talked about so far, Carla, and you've got loads of pearls of wisdom, that one has to be the soundbite of this entire interview, and we're not even done yet. That is just a hallelujah.
Thank you.
Very, very important, and you just nailed the script. Of course, you know where you're coming from with that, but that I couldn't imagine saying it any better.
Thank you.
And Carla, what is the 90-day rule?
Yes, the 90-day rule is to understand that whenever you are going into a new environment or you're starting a new project, you have about 90 days before you can put points on the board. It's been my experience that it's a natural human response that in about a quarter after someone has been new onto an assignment or in a job, people start to informally evaluate you. And most people make the mistake of thinking, I'm going into a new organization, so I have a year before I'm evaluated. People are already starting to ask the question, was she a good addition to the team? You know, is she going to do well here? Is she a superstar? Those questions start to happen, as I said, in about a quarter. So you need to orient yourself that I'm going to put some points in the board on the first 90 days. Either I'm going to complete a project, partially complete a project, demonstrate that I understand what the key success factors are, build these key relationships. Whatever it is that is of value that will impact your success, you need to position yourself to do that in 90 days.
Yes. Yeah, that's brilliant. And that's all sort of coming out of the expect to win side of the fence. Now, your new book, Carla, coming out at day after Christmas, I believe, is called Strategize to Win.
Yes.
And it's available for pre-order now on Amazon for our listeners. Perhaps you could compare and contrast how this book differs from your first book, Carla, and kind of expand on what readers can expect to learn from it.
Yes, and Expect to Win, it was a compilation of all those pearls that I learned, Kelly, the hard way that I had no idea about, but that I know would help you to maximize your success in the seat that you're sitting in or the seat that you aspire to sit in. Strategize to Win was actually inspired by, I'd say, the younger professionals who I would encounter in talking about Expect to Win. There were lots of questions about how do I figure out what I really want to do, or I got a job coming out of college because I had all this debt, and now I'm 6-7 years into it, and this is not working for me, and I'm not really sure what I want to do, or a professional who'd been working for 15 years and decided that they actually want to make a switch, and they're not quite sure how to do it. So this is about how do you tell and sell your story. I find that this is a critical skill that a lot of people don't have, which causes them to fail in interviews or causes them to not be able to get that dream job or that dream opportunity because they don't know how to position themselves for it. So the first third of the book is how do you figure out what you want to do. I give a nice template for how you figure that out and how do you position yourself for the job that you want and how do you sell into that opportunity. The middle part of the book is, okay, you have a job. Now here are a few other pearls that you need to be aware of, like understanding the difference between performance currency and relationship currency, understanding how to manage through change when change happens to you, understanding how to create change when you want to make it happen. How do you get innovative ideas adopted in your organization? What kind of profile do you have? Are you a safe pair of hands, a good soldier, a yes man? Because depending on your profile, that will impact your compensation depending on the economic environment and the kind of leader that you have. And the last third of the book is suppose you've been out for 10 or 15 years raising your family or doing something else. How do you reposition to get back into the workforce? Or suppose you got fired. How do you tell that story and position yourself for a great opportunity on the other side of that experience? So
right.
That's a quick synopsis of Strategize to Win.
Boy, and so well summarized. I love it.
Thank you.
What's one specific insight, Carla, that you can pluck from the book that you think is most important for aspiring businesswomen today? I can tell the book's chock full of them. Maybe you could pluck out one as an example.
Yes, the most important one that I'd point to right away, Kelly, is understanding the difference between performance currency and relationship currency. And I don't often give gender-specific advice, but this is one that I think is particularly poignant for women. Women tend to hug performance currency, and performance currency is valuable and it's important because it can do three things for you. If you have stellar performance in your job, it certainly will get you noticed. Number one. Number two, it'll get you paid and promoted. And number three, it might even attract a sponsor for you. But that's really valuable in the early days of your career. As you get more senior, your ability to move up is a function of somebody's judgment about whether or not you're ready, judgment about whether or not others will follow you and are you a good leader, judgment about whether or not this is too much of a stretch assignment and will it cause you to fail and move off of your current trajectory. Judgment. And judgments are directly influenced by relationships. So if you don't have strong relationships, you're not top of mind when someone is thinking about who should be at the top of the class in compensation or who should get promoted or who should get positioned for that overseas assignment. So you must invest, over-invest in the relationship currency after about 4 or 5 years into your career.
Yeah, and I would really pivot off of that comment by saying that has been a hallmark to my own success. Why people call me a super connector in my role is because I invested a lot in building powerful relationships that were established on trust over the long term and that I bring value to even now and then benefit from when, you know, engaging with clients who need access to those kind of people.
Yes.
So that's just so powerful, the networking and the relationships. Again, nobody ever really emphasizes the importance of that.
And I have found it to be very, very important, and one of the reasons that I think women have at the margin a tougher time as they get more senior, because we continue to invest in the performance and not in the relationships.
Indeed, indeed. And Carla, what's one piece of advice you wished you had from yourself as you are today to yourself as you were just getting started in your career?
Yeah, there's a lot, Kelly, but if you made me choose, I would probably say that perception point that I talked about earlier, understanding that perception is a co-pilot to reality. How people perceive you will directly impact how they deal with you. And
right.
That if you want to maximize your success, you should understand the adjectives that are associated with success. For the seat that you're sitting in or the seat that you aspire to sit in, and your behavior should be consistent with those adjectives if you want to be seen as a superstar in your environment.
Absolutely. And the importance of having a brand of sorts, you know, really standing out in your field as opposed to just being one of many sheep.
Absolutely.
Now, the last we're down to our last couple of questions because I'm mindful of your time, Carla, today, but I want to kind of wind down with a little bit of going back to the beginning of the conversation around your passion and your background in gospel singing. Do you still make time to do that as a priority with everything else you're juggling?
Oh, absolutely. I have the privilege of singing with two choirs. I sing with the St. Charles Gospelites at St. Charles Borromeo Church up in Harlem, and we sing the first, second, and fourth Sundays of every month at the 9:30 Mass. And I also sing with the Mark Howell Singers, which is an interfaith choir primarily based out of Harlem, but made up of singers from a number of different churches. And we sing different genres of music and perform several times throughout the year. And as you know, Kelly, every other year I generally do a Carnegie Hall benefit concert at Carnegie Hall where all of the proceeds go to A Better Chance, Inc., St. Charles Borromeo School up in Harlem, and Bishop Kenny High School in Jacksonville, Florida.
Boy, the next time I'm in New York, I'm going to want to try to catch one of those performances for sure.
Yes, come on up.
You know I will. Well, before we finish our chat, Carla, I always like to save this last question for the end, and it's essentially a legacy question. What comes next for you beyond all of your illustrious accomplishments so far? What's the one project or collaboration you might have dreamed about but you haven't yet started creating?
Well, if I give them to you from two different genres. If I say professionally here at in my work at Morgan Stanley, there are a couple of new initiatives that we're working on, especially around multicultural clients, and I hope to be wildly successful and create value for the firm in an area that we have not fully exploited heretofore. And from a singer's perspective, I certainly hope that my next album will be one that will get me a Grammy. I've gotten a Grammy nomination, but I'd like to get the Grammy.
I'm with you on that. That's fantastic, Carla. Well, I wish you so much continued success across all of those different endeavors. And again, I'm very privileged and appreciative that you made the time today to join us for this call.
I thank you very much, Kelly. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thank you for the privilege of being able to have the conversation for your listeners.
Yeah, thanks again. And as usual, I'd like to thank my show producer, Jessica Mastors, and of course our wonderful listeners who join us here each week. We'll hear you all again next week on the next episode of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.